106.6.
I'm Dom Robinson, and you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with me, Dom Robinson. It's a new weekly show where I look, well, it's not quite new anymore, it's been going a little while now. It's a weekly show where I look through the week's releases in movies, video games, plus the charts, and look at what's new on TV and news for all three. And you can hear my voices starting to go already. DVDfever.co.uk is a non-profit website and has recently had a revamp, so please take a look. If you've got anything else, anything to say about anything you hear on the show, please get in touch via the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/DVDFeverShow. You also see on there lots of trailers and links to gameplay footage of anything you hear on the show for this week. Excuse me. First thing we've got coming up in the first hour is all about films. We're starting off with a review of The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec, which is out this week. Then we have the top 10 movie charts. New cinema releases, including Spy Kids 4 and the Inbetweeners movie. And also new DVD releases, including Source Code and Quarantine 2, as well as some film news. I also mentioned on just recently on BBC Click, I had a mention for my podcast, which I'll give you the address in a minute. recently they had a piece from LJ Rich about podcasts and asked people to send in their thoughts about what they think makes the best podcast. I tweeted, "I think mine makes the best one." And I knew it was going to feature in the show beforehand, with Spencer giving a tongue-in-cheek, sarcastic response of, "Of course you do, Dom." So it did give me a laugh when that came on. So, yeah, I put a link to that on the Facebook page as well, so you can see it in all its glory. And the address of the website for any of my podcasts, just go to mixcloud.com/Dom Robinson. Okay, now with the review of this new film, The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec. I don't even remember this particular film hitting UK cinemas back in April, but you soon realise the reason why it had a limited release. The opening credits set it up as an intriguing female Indiana Jones-style adventure, the kind of thing a studio would turn into a franchise if they got the chance. The film also starts with a rambling voiceover that lasts over 10 minutes. The year is 1911, where women did the can-can and men had the most ridiculous moustaches of all time. Professor Marie-Joseph Esperandio is an elderly man who got a degree in physics at the age of 16, and 35 years later, his research resulted in a book, Is There Life After Death? Then cut to a pterodactyl hatching from an egg in the archaeological museum by the Seine, which we learn is somehow taking its movements from the professor, who's back at home. Adele Blanc-Sec, Louise Bourgeon, is a woman who writes novels about her adventures, and a publisher has just sent her off to unravel the mystery of the last Incas. When we meet her, she and her band of not very merry men climb down into an Egyptian tomb that was once used to prepare mummies. Upon opening a secret door, she finds a gun pointed at her head, thanks to the inhospitable treatment of her compatriots. The Indiana Jones comparisons continue when, instead of the Nazis, here we have Professor Juve Lute, an unrecognisable Matthew Almaric, with a whole heap of prosthetics on. Or perhaps he's just in hiding after appearing as baddie Dominic Green in the last James Bond film, Quantum of Solace, which was quite frankly appalling. So he and his henchmen turn up to break up the party. Adele has come to seek out the tomb of Patmosis, a professor of medicine and the personal doctor of Ramses II. Apparently he was the greatest medical expert in ancient Egypt, and she needs him to make her sister better. Apparently a twin, even though you can certainly see they don't look alike. Anyway, sister, she fell into a sort of wide-awake coma after a bizarre and unfortunate accident during a game of tennis, which has left a hatpin sticking through her brain from back to front. Although given the fact that Patmosis is practically carbonised, I really don't see how that'll help her. Well, that's where Professor Esperandio's book comes into play in resurrecting the Doctor. The movie has a great visual style, as you'd expect from Luc Besson, but it is rather a mess, and not one that I found particularly engaging. That said, there are some amusing moments as Adele sneaks in to try and rescue the Professor. The problem with The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec is that she has no extraordinary adventures. There's just a pterodactyl flying around all the time, which only Professor Esperandio is able to control. But then he's due to be put to death shortly, so cue another problem for our heroine to resolve. There's a greedy cop Inspector Capone, and a whole host of implausible French characters, usually with silly tashes and often fat. So it's just stereotype city. Oh, and throw in a 23-year-old scientist, Andrei Zabrowski, who's in love with Adele, just to add to the predictability. Overall, I'm not really sure who this will appeal to. It's too silly for adults, and while elements of it would suit young children, the subtitles would put them off. And the brief bit of nudity when Louise Bourgeon is in the bath would preclude it from being shown before the watershed when it comes to TV. Presented in the original theatrical ratio and on Blu-ray in 1080p high definition, there's nothing to complain about with the picture, which looks crisp and clear throughout, bringing the evocative look of the period to the screen. Audio-wise, the film is presented in DTS 5.1 HD Master Audio and does make use of this early on when it starts off being all Indiana Jones, but then scales back on this when there's far too little going on during the majority of the rest of the film. There's a few extras on here. We've got a making of, which is a three-part segment looking at the genesis of the film and how Luc Besson came to work with the creator of the books, Jacques Tardy, as well as casting Louise Bourgeon as Adele. It's also using special effects to create the Paris of 1911, as so many things have now changed, as well as the relationship between Adele and her sister. There's also interviews with Luc Besson and most of the cast. I've not sat through all of these myself, but yeah, if you did really enjoy the film, then they will be worth a look, because they usually go on for about 15 minutes apiece. There's an extra call in the studio where firstly we see Louise Bourgeon singing in the studio, and then we get a very weird song with even weirder animation being played. Not quite sure what that's all about. And then finally, a trailer which lasts about 90 seconds, which makes it look far better than it actually is, generally because it takes too much footage from the best bit at the beginning. So the scores for this film, the film itself, I'm going to give it a 2 out of 10, because it's just not good at all. Picture, though, is a 10 out of 10. Sound, 7 out of 10. Extras, 3. But overall, a 7 out of 10. So if you did enjoy it, maybe worth a rental at least. Okay, in a moment, we're going to be having a look at the movie charts, top 10 movie charts. And in a minute, we'll be having a little bit of music from Jerry Rafferty, The Night Owl. This is 106.6.
106.6.
In this section, we'll be having a look at the top 10 movie charts, and I go through the US movie charts here, because I've mentioned several times before the UK ones just don't seem to be available anymore these days. So here we go. In at number one, well, not in at number one, it's been number one a little while now. We've got Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Now, normally I go through the whole sort of plot breakdown about what the film's about, but given that it's been, before it even got released, it was hanging around or getting a mention on the TV every 5 minutes when he turned it on. So I think everyone's well aware of what the plot's about. For my money, when I was watching the trailer, it seemed to play out exactly as you'd expect and just didn't grab me. Can't be any worse than watching Tim Burton's version from back in 2001 with Helena Bonham Carter probably not needing any makeup at all. That film just plodded on along for 2 hours and just served to be predictable and boring. But for those who are interested in this new film, it's out now. And number two, we've got a film called The Help. That's taken $25.5 million this week. The weekend. Set in Mississippi during the 1960s, Skeeter, Emma Stone, is a Southern society girl who returns from college determined to become a writer, but turns her friends' lives and a Mississippi town upside down when she decides to interview the black women who have spent their lives taking care of prominent Southern families, but who are dunned down by the fact they're not treated as equals, for example, in not even being able to use the same bathroom as the residents of the house. Abilene, Viola Davis, Skeeter's best friend and housekeeper, is the first to open up to the dismay of her friends in the tight-knit black community. Despite Skeeter's lifelong friendships hanging in the balance, she and Abilene continue their collaboration, and soon more women come forward to tell their stories, and as it turns out, they have a lot to say. Along the way, unlikely friendships are forged, and a new sisterhood emerges, but not before everyone in town has a thing or two to say themselves when they become, unwittingly and unwillingly, caught up in the changing times. Now, watching the trailer, it just looked like a typical life-affirming chick flick where everything first goes wrong and then it eventually goes right and everything in the garden is rosy. I just came across as sickly sweet American junk, so I'd just say avoid that one. Number three, going straight in, number three, we've got Final Destination 5. And this film opens up with co-workers gathering together for a company retreat. Sam Lawton has prepared the breakfast before the bus ride. His friend Peter is awaiting everyone else's arrival for the trip. Molly Harper, Sam's girlfriend, arrives, and she then breaks up with him due to his dreams of going to Paris to be an apprentice for his mentor. Meanwhile, Peter's girlfriend Candice, an intern for the company and a gymnast, comes along with rival Olivia Castle. Molly is hit upon by Isaac Palmer, a co-worker and womaniser. Sam then goes to the construction wing of the building to find his other friend, Nathan Gregory, a supervisor who has a hard time dealing with construction worker Roy. Nathan and Sam regroup and head on the bus to their destination. As the bus heads up to the bridge, Sam notices the road's construction is rather suspicious, and he begins to have weird feelings while on the bus. The bus is stopped by a traffic operator, and then the bridge starts to crack. Sam watches as each of the co-workers die, excluding Molly, who reaches safety. Sam then comes to, realising the incident has yet to occur. He and Molly leave the bus, and Peter, Candice, Olivia, Nathan, Isaac and Dennis follow. The bridge collapses and Sam rushes all of his friends to safety. Well, you know what's going to come next. I haven't even seen the fourth film yet, which was entitled The Final Destination, so they clearly lied. And there's no one famous in the cast other than Tony Todd, again. Watching the trailer, it does look like a great deal of fun, though, so I'll be sure to catch up with number four before seeing this. But, I mean, I love the first two films, but the third one was rather a disappointment. That was the one set on the roller coaster. Yeah, I didn't like that one very much. Also, going straight in, at number four, we've got 30 Minutes or Less. We've got Nick. Jesse Eisenberg is a slacking pizza delivery driver who has trouble completing the 30 minutes or less policy that his employers issue, and it causes him to get yelled at by his boss, Brett Gelman. He hangs out with his friend Chet, Aziz Ansari, a substitute teacher. After a nasty argument between the two over Chet finding out that Nick has sex with Chet's sister Katie, who Nick still has feelings for, and Nick finding out that Chet was the reason Nick's parents divorced after he told Nick's dad that his wife had an affair with a lifeguard, they break off their friendship. However, one day, Nick has to deliver a pizza to a house owned by two men dressed in monkey masks, who strap a bomb to his chest and tell him that he has to rob a bank within 9 hours, otherwise they'll set it off. Cue a fast trip over to the school to pick up Chet, and then to the bank. Now, watching the trailer, there were a couple of laughs in there, and it looked slightly intriguing. But then I thought, well, it comes from the director of Zombieland, which, for my money, was fantastic and inventive for the first 30 minutes, and then just completely fell apart. So I can't wholly recommend this. Number five, we've got The Smurfs. Number six, Cowboys and Aliens. And number seven, Captain America, the First Avenger. Number eight, Crazy Stupid Love. Number nine, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part Two. Number 10, we've got the change-up, which went in to the charts last week. Now, in that one, growing up together, Mitch, Ryan Reynolds and Dave, Jason Bateman, were inseparable best friends. But as the years have passed, they've slowly drifted apart. While Dave is an overworked lawyer, husband and father of three, Mitch has remained a single, quasi-employed man-child who has never met a responsibility he liked. To Mitch, Dave has it all. A beautiful wife, Jamie, Leslie Mann, kids who adore him, and a high-paying job at a prestigious law firm. To Dave, living Mitch's stress-free life without obligation or consequence would be a dream come true. Following a drunken night out together, Mitch and Dave's worlds are turned upside down when they wake up in each other's bodies and proceed to freak out. Despite the freedom from their normal routines and habits, the guys soon discover that each other's lives are nowhere near as rosy as they once seemed. Further complicating the matters are Dave's sexy legal associate, Sabrina, Oliver Wilde, and Mitch's estranged father, Alan Arkin. With time not on their side, Mitch and Dave comically struggle to avoid completely destroying each other's lives before they can find a way to get their old ones back. Now, watching the trailer, my heart sank when it said it came from the same writer as The Hangover, as that never attracted me. Now, but this one does seem to have, you know, some good laughs and neat comic timing to it. Whether that can be maintained for almost 2 hours is anyone's guess, however. And just before I finish, one film that's completely, well, just about missed the top 10 in America is Glee, the 3D concert movie, which only took $5.7 million. I couldn't care less about Glee, to be honest. But it finally seems that the bubble has burst, if that can't even break into a top 10 amongst a load of films which have been out for a while. Okay, so that's all there, the top 10 for this week. And we'll have you look at some cinema releases in a moment. First of all, we're going to have a bit of music from Flash in the Pan, and they're waiting for a train. I know exactly how they feel. This is 106.6.
106.6.
And in this section, we're taking a look at cinema releases. I'm going to be starting off with Cowboys and Aliens, which is coming out tomorrow over here, although most of these films are coming out on Friday. So Cowboys and Aliens, it's the Old West, where a lone cowboy leads an uprising against a terror from beyond our world. 1873, Arizona Territory. A stranger with no memory of his past stumbles into the hard desert town of Absolution. The only hint to his history is a mysterious shackle that encircles one wrist. What he discovers is that the people of Absolution don't welcome strangers, and nobody makes a move on its streets unless ordered to do so by the iron-fisted Colonel Dollarhide, Harrison Ford. It's a town that lives in fear, but Absolution is about to experience fear it can scarcely comprehend as a desolate city is attacked by marauders from the sky. Screaming down with breathtaking velocity and blinding lights to abduct the helpless one by one, these monsters challenge everything the residents have ever known. Now the stranger they rejected is their only hope for salvation. As this gunslinger starts to slowly remember who he is and where he's been, he realizes he holds a secret that could give the town a fighting chance against an alien force. With the help of the elusive traveller, Ella, Olivia Wilde, he pulls together a posse comprised of former opponent's townsfolk, Dollarhide and his boys, outlaws and Apache warriors, all in danger of annihilation. United against a common enemy, they will prepare for an epic showdown for survival. The cast features Daniel Craig, Clancy Brown, Sam Rockwell and Keith Carradine. And from the trailer, what starts off looking like a typical Wild West film soon changes halfway through when the aliens arrive and start shooting up the place. So it looks worth seeing, actually. Also out this week, on Friday, we've got the Inbetweeners movie. Now, I couldn't find a synopsis for this film other than Will, Simon, Jay and Neil go on holiday to Malia after finishing year 13 at school. Starring Simon Bird, Joe Thomas and James Buckley, I never managed to get into the series. I know a lot of people raved about it, but I just thought it was being childish for the sake of it. Maybe it's because I'm not 14, I don't know. Watching the trailer, I got one laugh out of it, that's with the ignorance of the characters, when one of them says, "First stop, the Minoan Palace of Knossos." A second says, "Oh, we're not come here to look at boring Greek ruins." And a third one dismissed it as saying, "Yeah, you can look at that anywhere." Other than that, I think I'll pass. Also out this week, we've got Spy Kids, all the time in the world in 4D. And this one, on the surface, Marissa Cortez Wilson, Jessica Alba, has it all. Married to a famous spy-hunting television reporter, a new baby and intelligent twin stepkids, but in reality trying to mother Rebecca and Cecil, who clearly don't want her around, is her toughest challenge yet. Also her husband, Wilbur, Joel McHale, wouldn't know a spy if he lived with one, which is exactly the case. Marissa's a retired secret agent. Marissa's world is turned upside down when the maniacal timekeeper, Jeremy Piven, threatens to take over the planet, and she's called back into action by the head of OSS, home of the greatest spies and where the now-defunct Spy Kids division was created. With Armageddon quickly approaching, Rebecca and Cecil are thrust into the action when they learn their boring stepmom was once a top agent. Now the world's most competitive 10-year-olds are forced to put their bickering aside and rely on their wits. With a little help from a couple of very familiar spy kids, Carmen and Junie Cortez, and some mind-blowing gadgets, they might just be able to save the world and possibly bring their family together while they're at it. In short, from the trailer, there's a baddie stopping time, there's two annoying kids, and there's a talking dog voiced by Ricky Gervais. I do rather like Gervais when he's putting together a programme or a film that he's created, but anything else, quite frankly, is pretty much junk. Also out this week, and you've got to mention, well, just falling out of the top 10 films in America this week, we've got Glee, the 3D concert movie. This is the only film I've not put a trailer for on the Facebook page, so I couldn't sit through it. So this is the film of the concert tour performed by members of the cast of the popular TV series Glee. The tour, created by series creator Ryan Murphy, was designed due to the overwhelming response to the series. but obviously not an overwhelming response in the box office in America. But the show reached North America, the United Kingdom and Ireland, and Murphy states the series, soundtrack and concerts were an additional revenue stream for the series. The tour received great responses from both music critics and fans of the series, and the first North American leg of the tour in 2010 was seen by over 70,000 spectators, generating over $5 million in ticket sales and ranking ninth on the Billboard Hot Tours list. The movie features all 14 regular cast members of Glee, plus the Warblers, who perform several members of which featured in both season 1 and 2. It also features Jane Lynch live on stage instead of pre-recorded material, and Gwyneth Paltrow performing Forget You live. And also that week we've got the Guard in this film. Sergeant Jerry Boyle, Brendan Gleeson, is a small-town Irish cop with a confrontational personality. He joins forces with a straight-laced FBI agent, Don Cheadle, to take on an international drug smuggling gang in Ireland's Connemara Gaeltacht. A murder which appears to be the work of an occult serial killer is the first incident, the relevance of which is then revealed by Boyle in a briefing by an FBI agent sent to liaise with the Gardaí. A web of bribery, blackmail and killings ensues. Boyle and Everett form an unlikely alliance, and with the unwitting help of the IRA, bring about a bloody do new one. The film also stars Liam Cunningham and Mark Strong, and it's a comedy, although from the description it doesn't sound like one. However, the trailer certainly points it in the comedy direction and makes the film worth a look. Okay, that's your films out for this week. In a little while, we'll be having a look at the DVDs that are out this week. But first of all, I'll have a bit more music. I've got Elton John with I Don't Want to Go On With You Like That. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, in this section, we'll be having a look at the DVDs out this week, starting off with AC/DC, Let There Be Rock. And this one, it's a legendary concert that's been long tricky to track down. AC/DC, Let There Be Rock has finally got a long overdue disc release, and fortunately it's been worth the wait. The concert was originally released in 1980, but it has remained steadfastly hard to get hold of. Let There Be Rock's arrival on Blu-ray, it's also out on DVD as well, brings it with it 13 songs, including some of the band's finest work. The songs themselves are further interspersed with interviews and backstage material, and it's been put together extremely well. It positively glistens in high definition, and it simply never looked better. But inevitably, it's the performance itself that makes Let There Be Rock so special. This is the work of a very strong set of musicians at the very top of their game. The concert and the depiction of it here is superb, and it's a genuine musical treat. There's an argument that for the disc release, some tidying up work has been done on the audio, which, well, if it had happened, it wouldn't have hurt. But given that it's been so long since Let There Be Rock has been available, it's only a minor quibble. The key factor here is that it's an important musical concert, get me words out, which has been made properly available at last, so that many more generations will be able to enjoy all that Let There Be Rock has to offer. Special features on this disc include AC/DC, the bedrock of riff, Angus Young, a true guitar monster, Bon Scott, the pirate of rock and roll, AC/DC, a rock solid legacy. There's also quite a few other extras which I wouldn't have time to put on here, but yeah, I've made mention of this on the Facebook page as well, so you'll be able to have a look at them there. Also out this week, we've got Source Code. Now, Captain Colter Stevens, Jake Gyllenhaal, is on a mission to identify a bomber who destroyed a train just hours earlier, and he plans to kill thousands more with a much larger explosion in the heart of Chicago. A top-secret program named Source Code allows Colter to briefly exist as another man in the parallel reality of the doomed commuter train. Each time he returns to the train, Colter has just 8 minutes to uncover the bomber's identity. The more he learns, the more convinced he becomes that he can prevent the deadly blast from ever happening, unless time runs out first. Filled with mind-boggling twists and turns and heart-pounding suspense, Source Code is a smart action thriller directed by Duncan Jones, Moon, and also starring Michelle Monaghan, Eagle Eye, Due Date, Vera Farmiga, Up in the Air and The Departed, and Jeffrey Wright from Quantum of Solace and Syriana. Special features in this one include an audio commentary with Jake Gyllenhaal plus Duncan Jones and the writer Ben Ripley, also cast and crew insights, and a trivia track. I provided a clip to the trailer on the Facebook page, but I don't want to see too much of it myself, as it's a film I've not yet seen, and I don't want anything being spoiled. I know from Duncan Jones' previous movie, The Wonderful Moon, the trailer spoiled the whole twist in the film. I don't want to end up in the same position here. Also out this week, we've got Angry Boys. Chris Lilley amps up his acutely observed character-based comedy style in the highly acclaimed mockumentary series Angry Boys. He brings to life Daniel and Nathan Sims, identical twins who live on a farm in South Australia. Ruth Sims, a.k.a. Gran, a prison guard who works at a juvenile justice centre for the boys. US rapper S. Mouse, who finds himself on the house arrest after doing a poo on a police car. And former world surfing champion Blake Oakfield, a surf gang leader who lost his career, shall we say, in a shooting. And Jen Okazaki, a domineering mother manager of a skateboard champion son and creator of the Gay Style Enterprises empire. I know some people have raved about this, but I saw a brief bit and knew it just wasn't going to go for me. It wasn't going to be for me. I didn't get into Chris Lilley's previous series, Summer Heights High, either. Just thought too weird for its own good. Also out this week, we've got Quarantine 2, Terminal. And this one, I'll describe this film first, but in Quarantine 2, it says, earlier tonight, a bizarre disease was unleashed in a run-down Los Angeles tenement. No one got out alive, but something escaped. Aboard Flight 318, the first symptoms begin to show. As the infection begins to take root, innocent passengers suddenly transform into terrifying, bloodthirsty killers. Forced to land at an isolated terminal and surrounded by armed government agents, the crew and passengers grow increasingly desperate. The only question now is how far will they go to survive? Now, the reason I was sort of stumbling a bit before is because I realised you can buy the second film on its own. There's also a box set with both films in, if you really want to double your pleasure, in a way. But watching the trailer, I can see it's a typical film of innocent civilians getting picked off one by one. Whether it remains entertaining, well, it remains to be seen. The score of 5.5 out of 10 on the Internet Movie Database doesn't really fill me with hope, though. But if it is for you, you'll be pleased to know the special features include commentary with writer-director John Eric Dowdle and the producer Drew Don Dowdle. There's also Making a Quarantine and Dressing the Infected, Robert Hall's makeup design. Other films out this week, we've got Mars Needs Moms, Sapphire, The Strange World of Gurney Slade, Theirs is the Glory, which is one of my granddad's favourite films, Uninhabited. And if you're into TV box sets, also out this week we've got 90210 Season 3. That's the new series, as it were, as opposed to Beverly Hills 90210. Agatha Christie's Marple, Series 1-5 box set. Dramarama's Spooky, a complete series. Gossip Girl, Series 4. Louis Theroux, The Odd, The Bad and The Godly. A box set of all the Mock the Week Too Hot for TV compilations. And if you really want the pain, My Family Series 11. Blu-ray premieres include Curse of the Golden Flower, Earth and Space, How the Earth Was Made and the Universe, IMAX Deep Sea, and also the Spy Kids trilogy, just tying in with the cinema release of the fourth film there. Now in a minute we'll be having some film news for you, but first have a bit of music and we'll be having The Blow Monkeys, and It Doesn't Have to Be This Way. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now in this section we'll be having a look at the film news, just to take us up to the top of the hour. And we're going to start off with the news that Olivia Wilde is possibly to play porn star Linda Lovelace. In an interview with E! Online, Wilde admitted she was considering the role in the upcoming biopic. She said, "I'm being very careful about my next project since I'm now in a position where I can be really picky. On playing Lovelace," she added, "it would be a tremendous honour. It's such a cool role. She was a fascinating woman, with where she came from Deep Throat to then working with Gloria Steinem and Nora Ephron. It's really fascinating." Just to clarify things, Wilde is talking about a possible role in a new project from Howl directors Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman. There is another Lovelace movie entitled Inferno currently in the works. Inferno will star Malin Akerman, who replaced Lindsay Lohan as a porn star turned activist. Could this be another case of two conspicuously similar movies arriving within months of each other, like Capote and Infamous, Deep Impact and Armageddon, Ants and A Bug's Life et al.? Lovelace, real name, Linda Susan Borman, became internationally famous with Breakout, Skin Flick, Deep Throat, before later stating that she was forced against her will into porn by a former husband, Chuck Traynor. She went on to become an outspoken anti-pornography activist, and considering her fame and the drama and scandal that defined her life, it's no surprise that she has been singled out for the movie treatment. If Wild signs on, it could be a hell of a role for her, but the movie could suffer if Inferno is first out of the gate. Wild is currently enjoying a box office run, a good box office run after being in Tron Legacy at the Christmas. She's also in Cowboys and Aliens out now, and The Change-Up, which is in the top 10 American charts at the moment, and it's coming out later in the UK with also films called In Time and Butter coming later in the year. Excuse me. So the news this week, got Monsters director Gareth Edwards is pitching an untitled robot Star Wars movie. British filmmaker Gareth Edwards burst onto the scene in 2010 with his award-winning indie sci-fi movie Monsters, a critical favourite that cost just $500,000 to make. For his follow-up, Edwards said that he would be developing a sci-fi movie with Timur Bekmambetov from Wanted that would be way more ambitious than Monsters. It'd be an epic human story set in a futuristic world without humanity. Before Edwards could get much further on that intriguing project, legendary directors hired him to direct their new Godzilla movie, and nothing more was heard about it. Now, however, Slash Film has revealed that Edwards is still pitching his as yet untitled epic, which he apparently is describing as a robot Star Wars movie. According to Slash Film's good sources, Edwards' movie will revolve around a young human child, probably around 5 years old, and a robot who will travel around the galaxy in search of mankind's origin in a world void of humanity and filled with robots. Edwards is apparently looking to make the movie $35 million, a number incredibly small for a modern effects heavy sci-fi movie like this one purports to be. And considering how much Edwards was able to accomplish with just $500,000 last time, $35 million would be more than enough. Now, Jesse Eisenberg may be the double for Richard Ayoade's next film. Given just how well-received IT Crowd co-star Richard Ayoade's first film, Submarine, was, it's no surprise that he's attracting top-name talent for his follow-up. And so it has proved to be with the fact that Jesse Eisenberg will star in the double. The casting hasn't been officially announced yet, so it's just a rumour at the moment. That said, Ayoade hasn't picked something easy for his second stab at filmmaking. He's adapted Dostoevsky's eponymous novella. Not familiar with it? Not a shock, but the basic story finds a Russian government clerk whose life begins to fall apart when he discovers that an identical man, right down to the details of his life, including his name, starts working in his office. Since this is an indie production, it's unlikely Ayoade will be splashing out on the technology David Fincher used to create the Winklevoss twins in The Social Network. With a double dose of Eisenberg being paranoid and twitchy, sounds like it could work. Another bit of news this week, we've got the news that Mike Myers is to say, yeah baby, to a fourth Austin Powers. It's been nearly 9 years since we've seen Austin Powers, a British spy who, despite the need for serious dentist work, was a ladies' man and brought to the masses a collection of catchphrases. These don't sound good with my voice as it is today. His catchphrases were, oh behave, groovy baby, and yeah baby, yeah. Well prepared to see more of the International Man of Mystery as Mike Myers is in talks to do a fourth Austin Powers. In addition to starring, Myers is expected to write and produce the movie. Aside from voicing the title character in the Shrek franchise, there's been little of Myers on the big screen since he last played Powers and Dr. Evil and Goldmember and all the rest in 2002's Goldmember. Myers seemingly went into hiding after his 2008 movie The Love Guru bombed. But although he did have a small part in Quentin Tarantino's what I can only call as Inglourious Bees. The comedy made just $40 million worldwide, which wasn't good at all. Despite The Love Guru, there's plenty of reasons to expect audiences to return to theatres for another Austin Powers movie. Goldmember made nearly $300 million worldwide, the highest in the franchise. But surprising there was a franchise at all, because the first one, International Man of Mystery, made just $53 million. Not a bad figure for a goofy comedy, but it wasn't until the movie became a bigger hit on video that the audiences began clamouring for more of Austin Powers. However, there's no word yet if Austin Powers director Jay Roach will return for a fourth film, and the same goes for Mini-Me, Vern Troyer. Okay, so that's all everything to do with films for this week. Coming up in the second hour, we've got a mixture of video games and TV, starting with a review of the arcade classic Dragon Slayer 2 Time Warp. But to take us up to the top of the hour, we've got Bruce Hornsby with The Way It Is. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, in the second hour of the show, we've first start off with a video game section. We've got a review of the Dragon's Lair, the arcade classic Dragon's Lair 2 Time Warp. Then we've got the top 10 games charts, some new video games releases, and also some video games news. And then we'll have the TV stuff in the second section, second half of the hour. Look back at Trolleyed on Sky 1 and Village SOS on BBC 1, plus a look ahead to some more programmes coming up. So we start off with a review of Dragon's Lair 2, Time Warp. Now, this, anyone who knows the original game knows how difficult it is. And it's actually, I put a link to the Facebook page to someone who's completed the whole game. So that's really worth a look, even if you've not played the game itself. Anyway, the review. 1983, what a time to be alive. For me, it was the best year for music, and also a time when I would frequent the arcade at the top of Oxford Road in Manchester, near to the Odeon on a Saturday afternoon. Packed with gaming machines, all wanting my 10p pieces, the one that drew my gaze the most was a title called Dragon's Lair. So what made it stand out from the crowd? Well, with every other game in the arcade created using computer graphics and played off a microchip, this one featured actual cartoon images coming from a laserdisc player inside the cabinet. Yes, there was a bit of technical jiggery-pokery inside to control it all, but between this and another game, Astron Belt, they were something the like of which we'd never seen before. For those who hadn't come across Astron Belt, it was a shoot-em-up where you could actually control a spacecraft that appeared on screen as graphics, but was programmed to react to the video footage being played on screen, which was generally space, the terrain of a planet, aliens flying about, or a huge fireball explosion when you died. Think Space Invaders, but a million times more cool. You could also sit down in its cockpit cabinet, something I remember later being used with the Star Wars arcade game, and anyone remembers playing that sit-down version will have many happy memories. Anyway, back to the plot, and the original Dragon's Lair had a very simple concept. You take the role of Dirk the Daring, a lanky knight who is somehow the object of desire for the gorgeous Princess Daphne. Well, I say gorgeous, but that'll sound like I'm attracted to a computer game character. Each location within the game comprises of beasties, potions, other items of interest, and at least one exit, although when there are multiple ones, all but one of them will be a red herring. Try and jump or walk through one of these and you'll end up losing a life. While taking in everything that's happening on screen, your only options are to move forward, backwards, left, right, or press fire to swish your sword at a baddie, and you would only be expected to learn a handful of moves in each scene. Contrast that with Dragon's Lair 2 Time Warp, released in 1991. And the premise here is that Dirk and Daphne are now married, with several children to their name. However, Daphne has been kidnapped by the evil wizard Mordrok to marry him instead, and he's not exactly a great catch. Split into 8 sections, Dragon's Lair 2 Time Warp takes you through various eras of history, as well as sometimes mixing in a heavy dose of fantasy as they take their cues from Alice in Wonderland, Sleeping Beauty and the like. However, the biggest problem with the game is that it's too damn difficult, and each section goes on too long. Well, the last couple are seemingly quite short after a sneaked a peek at the walkthrough on GameFAQs, as that's spelled game, FAQS. So you do end up getting mightily frustrated with it. Note how these sections follow in turn, rather than the original game's randomised scenes being played out from one to the other, often changing after a death. Graphics are, well, as everyone knows with these games, the graphics aren't graphics, they're the original animations by Don Bluth, previously one of the animators at Disney. So basically you're playing out a cartoon. When it comes to the audio, the basic stereo track certainly engages with the player. Yes, it's a long way from the Dolby Digital 5.1 you'd expect from a conventional release, but we are talking about a game that's 20 years old. As for the gameplay, most of the time the game responds perfectly well to the joystick, but occasionally if you press it too early, it'll assume you've pressed the wrong button and give you the requisite death animation. This is immensely annoying because the levels often run for 30 to 40 joystick movements and button presses without any checkpoints. It's bad enough trying to keep up even if you've mastered most of it and just need to learn the last few moves. It's also a royal pain when, given the limited movements available to you, you're presented with one that looks a bit diagonal and is not at all obvious which are the two ways you should push your joystick. Now, I said there are no checkpoints, But I was playing the original arcade game because I bought one of those, the big sort of stand-up main arcade machines, which is a, cost me a fair bit of money, but it's well worth it. If you import, you can import it on Blu-ray, because it was released in the US, but never let out over here, and that version does include checkpoints. If you've never played either Dragon Slayer game, then check out the original first, as having a run through that game will give you a good background into how the sequel operates. There's also, as I said, there's also gameplay footage, not from myself though, of the entire game on the Facebook page. So for that one, graphics I'd give, well, 10, can't be anything else. Sound is an 8, playability a 7, enjoyment an 8, the original was a 10. So overall, it's a good 8 out of 10. Okay, so that's a review of Dragon Slayer 2 Time Warp. I'll be having a look at the top 10 charts in a moment. First of all, just have a little bit of music, and it's going to be, in a moment, we're going to be having Kajagoogoo and Too Shy. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now in this section we have a look at the top 10 games charts, and also look at some new titles that are coming out on Friday. And well, the game charts is not, a lot more is coming out sort of later on, when the autumn really, well, the autumn started weather wise, but when the autumn starts in terms of games releases. So there's not a lot of changing in the top 10. Number 1, got Zumba Fitness again. Number 2, back up again, is Lego Pirates of the Caribbean. Number 3, it's Cars 2. Number 4, Dirt 3. Number 5 is FIFA 11. Number 6 is Lego Harry Potter Years 1 to 4. Number 7 is Just Dance 2, Extra Songs. Number 8, Call of Juarez, The Cartel. Number 9, The Sims 3. And at number 10, it's L.A. Noir. I've also got re-entries for number 29 for Skate 3. And number 35 with Just Cause 2. So I'd say, not much new game video games releases out this week, but anyway, there will be soon. But stuff that's out this week includes Xenoblade Chronicles. Now join the battle for Bionis to repel the invasion of the terrifying mechanical army and uncover the secrets of a mystical sword called the Monodo in Xenoblade. Xenoblade Chronicles is an epic role-playing game which takes place on an immense game world on the remains of two giant titans, and features fast-paced, real-time battling. The game heavily focuses on exploring vast landscapes and immerses you into the game with cinematic cutscenes. The story focuses on Shulk and the Monodo, a mystical sword that gives his bearer the great powers, and a war between humans and robots. The game's real-time battles has an action-orientated approach, giving you the chance to unleash special attacks and strategies by selecting them from a command gauge. The battling is also interlinked with the affinity between characters. Also out this week, we've got Arcana Heart 3, which is on the Xenoblade Chronicles, that was on the Wii, by the way. Arcana Heart 3, that's on Xbox 360 and PS3, which is a 2D arcade fighting game. And the plot is, if it needs one, is that the game's setting takes place in a fictional, somewhat futuristic Japan, combined with fantasy elements. In the previous game, Arcana Heart 2, surprisingly enough, a dimensional distortion occurred in the country's Kanto region, careful how you say that, caused by the primordial being known as Angelia Avalon. This event came to be known as the, here we go, Great Kanto Incident. The International Holy Spirit's institution suffered harshly after this, but restoration has begun, and about 2 months have elapsed. In this time, a family that had received technical assistance during the war in Europe created the Drexel Institution to resume its activities around the world. This was hiding in Japan, and the Western Europe was devastated by the office of the Holy Spirit, led by Mildred, who had since defected. The West branch of the Holy Spirit Rosenberg Agency had to be completely reconstituted. Shortly thereafter, a large number of dimensional distortions were observed through Japan. Drexel was a little unusual and natural, with his authority behind the scenes too. Japan embarked on a convergence of the Holy Office to gain control of the situation. They were looking closely into a part of an area of Japan that educates several maidens. The newcomer, given the ability of a maiden, had begun her activities from the branch in Rosenberg. With the authority acquired from Drexler, a major order had been given to seek the entirety of Japan after 6 days. That's a ridiculously long-winded sort of description for a game that's basically just a two-dimensional arcade fighting game. Also this week we've got Mystery Tales 2, The Spirit Mask on Nintendo DS. You are the witch, Melanie Signes, from the first game. This time she finds a strange Japanese mask and finds out all kinds of contradicting information about it. What's in the mask? A demon? An angel? Something else? Later the mask breaks and the spirit takes residence within Melanie's mind. She finally realises that the mask was actually a human being in the past, and he's got the gift of immortality by living in the mask, which is now broken, and two souls in one body is really not a good thing. Now they have to work together to solve the situation quickly before the very strong spirit takes over Melanie's mind, which the spirit wants to avoid as well, since he was a man when he lived and does not want to hurt Melanie. The problem is that the spirit's memory got damaged when the mask broke, and he doesn't know what to do. They start following the history of the mask through time. Melanie gets to know her awkward companion a lot better and start to have feelings for him. The spirit is also drawn to Melanie as if he knew her, but can't remember how and when. They visit Tibet, China, Malaysia and Japan together, have plenty of adventures and meet a human. And at some point, Senshi, the spirit, with the help of Melanie, manages to defend the shogun, from a deadly plot for which the Senshi, the living one, is offered the honour to become immortal by moving his soul into the mask. As a final plot twist, the living Senshi will not go into the mask. Instead, the spirit from Melanie's head goes into the mask, thus solving their problem. So there we go. Did that make any sense to you? Didn't make a great deal of sense to me. In a moment, we'll have a look at some video games news for this week, but we'll have a bit of music first, and we'll be having Queen and the Invisible Man. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Just going to have a look at some video games news that's out this week, starting with a Pac-Man Twitter client. Namco Bandai has released a new international version of its Pac-Man Twitter client on iTunes, originally launched in Japan earlier this year. Featuring all the standard Twitter functions, it comes with skins resembling the classic 1981 maze game, as well as legendary shooter Galaga, celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. When you update your timeline, characters on the screen move around to classic Pac-Man and Galaga melodies. Explain the press release. Furthermore, each time you reach a certain number of outgoing tweets, an on-screen roulette wheel appears and spins, giving you the chance to win a puzzle piece. Collect all the pieces and you're awarded a Pac-Man or Galaga wallpaper. Of course, I could have gone further playing the classic Pac-Man waka waka noise every time you tap in a letter, finally delivering the death sound when you reach 140 characters. Perhaps I'll save me that for the next update. Also, the BBC has expressed an interest in Kinect and developing for Nintendo's next console, the Wii U, it has been revealed. The Wii U has been described as a really interesting product by the broadcaster, especially if it had strong digital download functionality. BBC Digital and Games executive producer Simon Harris said, "I think the challenge is for us to get our brands as games into something like retail. We're very excited to hear what plans are in that area, and yes, we'll be looking at whether there are some really good strategic partnerships on our brands that we can bring to those platforms as well." Nintendo are currently a market leader on consoles, so when they do something, you better sit up and take notice to see if we can try and become involved in it. Harris also added that Kinect makes a huge amount of sense for some of the BBC's franchises. Well, BBC Worldwide has released retail titles such as last year's Doctor Who games, Evacuation Earth and Return to Earth. Its main focus is on digital releases. As well as the Doctor Who and Top Gear iPhone applications, it's been developing a Doctor Who multiplayer game and a second season of Doctor Who The Adventure Games. Also in the news this week, the PlayStation Vita can be used as a PS3 controller at launch. This is similar to how Nintendo's Wii U will have a controller that can operate its console, but the Vita controls a PS3. At a develop conference 2011, Sony Europe's R&D manager, Phil Rogers, addressed how developers could use the Vita as a PS3 controller. "The PS3 can send data down to Vita, and Vita can display it," Rogers explained. "You could use the unique features of Vita, such as gyroscope, touch front and back, as a control device for a PS3 game. It can run software on both devices and use the network to sync the game states. And that's pretty good, because then you have the processing power of the PS3 doing that work. Vita doing fancy graphics, however you want to do it. You're not sacrificing the PS3's CPU to be able to have a rich experience on Vita." In addition to using the PlayStation Vita as a controller, at E3 Sony announced cross-platform play, allowing players on both devices to play together. And Wipeout 2048 on Vita was the first game announced to use this feature, allowing players to race against friends playing Wipeout HD on PS3. The Vita's due to retail in America between $250 and $300, whereas it's going to launch in Europe and the UK in late October for approximately £230 a console. That's just a brief bit of video games news for this week, and we have a look at some TV stuff in the next section of the game. Next section of the show, rather. But first of all, just have a bit of music, and we'll have it Peter Gabriel with his Big Time. This is 106.6.
106.6.
And this half hour, last half hour of the show, we'll look at some TV programmes, some TV news to come as well. First of all, we'll start off with some TV programmes watched in the past week, starting with Village SOS. It says here that Sarah Beeny follows a passionate group of locals as they spend a year trying to rescue their community. When the residents of Talgarth near Brecon applied for a grant from the Big Lottery Fund to renovate a derelict mill, they had no idea what was in store. The mill last ground corn in 1946, but can a bunch of volunteers really turn its fortunes around? Now, before I saw it, I thought, well, I'm beginning to wonder whether the Sarah Beeny bubble has burst. Property Ladder was great entertainment at first, but eventually became just the same old, while Help My House Is Falling Down got old really fast, as it didn't do a great deal different from the show which made a name. Village SOS is something new, but we've all seen rows of shops disappear and our shopping centres turn into ghost towns, but while we decry it, we're all happy to go to the big-name supermarkets and great big shopping malls just off the motorway, as everything's under one roof. It's progress, whichever way you look at it. Anyway, when it came to watching this show, they had... it was fairly predictable. They had street parties. They had builders working for a pittance so they could get the mill back into full operation, especially getting the wheel in place so it could produce flour again. Overall, the show did seem rather fanciful. And they tried to build up tension by lots of aspects of getting the water to turn the wheel, all hinging on a delivery of concrete. I mean, at that point, I just couldn't cope with the tension whatsoever. Slowly and more slowly, they put together the mill and the village. And the whole village just did not a lot. The mill wasn't built in time, and the baking team had to form a contingency plan of some sort to convince people that their shop would open at some point. Eventually, the mill did open, and the village just had more visitors for the first time in years. But in the end, I just thought, Village SOS? Program SOS, more like. After that, we got Trolleyed on Sky One, which had... this is a new sitcom set in Warrington in the fictional supermarket of Valco. Julie, Jane Horrocks, is the acting deputy manager who works alongside store manager Gavin, Jason Watkins, to whom she is romantically attracted. Andy, Mark Addy, and Kieran, Nick Blood, are the store's butchers. And Katie, Janelle Cresswell, works on the checkouts and has a flirtatious relationship with Kieran. Margaret, Rita May, the oldest of the team, struggles to settle in. Well, after 5 minutes of this, I'd had bigger laughs at funerals. The first dreadful joke, which was so signposted that the punchline had to be repeated several times in order to ram it home, centred around Jane Horrocks telling the butchers that she was standing in for the deputy manager, and that made her the interim deputy manager. She then turned the word interim into a verb. Now, I'm not going to spell that one out for you, given the time of day this is, but it did make me think... haven't some sitcom writers managed to progress past the 70s yet? The tired and crude humour continued when one staff member said he was going to drop his kids off at the pool, and the token pensioner in the cast said bemusedly, "Oh, how old are they?" Before he then spelt it out for anyone who somehow didn't get it. I would add, just to add insult to injury, as episode one finished, the end credits were interrupted by the oh-so-hilarious voices from the cast about the fact there was an episode 2 coming next, along with a Tannoy-style announcement about it. Just dreadful. Episode 2 had a load more supposed jokes that went for crude without actually being funny, plus a few non-crude moments which were equally laugh-free. I'm afraid I just couldn't face watching the third episode. Can I think of anything good to say about it? Well, Sky One and a number of their other channels have, much to my surprise, taken to dropping their on-screen logo that tells you exactly what you already knew. That in this case, you were watching Sky One. And if you somehow forgot, and if it really mattered, you could simply press the info button on your remote and your Digibox would tell you. Out of all the channels broadcasting to date, I never thought it would be Sky to do this first. Technically, they don't completely drop it, but it does disappear after the first 20 seconds, so it's a bit like the brief, but the BBC, who have a brief logo of BBC at the bottom of the screen at the start of each of their shows. Although on most of their channels, they persist with a ridiculous logo at the top anyway. I know the commercial channels do it as well, but the BBC claim not to be ratings chasers, and they should be leading the way in getting rid of them. They did once have them on BBC One and BBC Two, back when Freeview, or digital terrestrial television it was back then, started in 1998, but they soon got shouted down by the general public, who didn't need to be treated like idiots. Anyway, a bit of a rant at the end of the dreadful trolley there. Although the rant was in Sky's favour, because they're the ones who have done the right thing. Apart from commissioning Trollied, of course. Anyway, have a bit of music, and then we're having a look at what's new coming up, plus some TV news. But the music in the meantime we'll be having will be Murrayhead and One Night in Bangkok. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Now, before we have some TV news, we'll have a quick look ahead to some shows that are coming up in the coming week. We've got, starting tonight on Channel 4 at 9 o'clock, we've got a seven-part series called Seven Dwarves. And during the Christmas pantomime season, all across Britain, many dwarves take on paying roles in the theatre. This brand-new observational documentary series follows the lives of seven dwarf actors as they live together and perform in a production of Snow White at Woking's New Victoria Theatre. Seven Dwarves offers rounded insights into the personal and professional lives of the dwarves and aims to cut across some of the preconceptions that small people often encounter. The first episode is Max's tale. In his telemarketing job, Max's 4'2" height isn't an issue, something that isn't the case when he leaves his friends and family to perform on stage for 8 weeks over Christmas. The Dwarves went through 7 weeks of constant 24/7 filming, and it shows them in their work and often follows them socially too. Later on in the series, we see Josh hiring himself out for stag do's in order to get handcuffed to the bridegroom. So that's Seven Dwarves starting tonight on Channel 4 at 9 o'clock. Something else I'll try and take a look at, well, we'll take a look at, see how long I can stand it, is Celebrity Big Brother, which returns no longer on Channel 4, but it's now on Channel 5, and it starts on Thursday at 9 o'clock, and it's then on daily. I think they're doing it for 3 weeks as a celebrity one before they'll go on to a normal one. Now, for this one, we don't know who's going to be in the house yet, apart from a rumour that Charlie Sheen being in there, although it's set to be the biggest house ever, rather than Channel 4 preferring to make them small and have a claustrophobic feel to it. Others tipped to be in it include Pamela Anderson, Amy Childs, Jed Wood, Kerry Katona, US party girl Tara Reid, who once used to be an actress, and Sally Berko, the wife of the House of Commons Speaker. Big Brother celebrity housemates will live in a plush pad, complete with spa area, outdoor pool, and five-star gym in the next series of the show. Photos of the luxurious home reveal a trendy living room, a luxurious bedroom with sumptuous bedding, and a sweeping spiral staircase from which contestants will enter and leave the house when they are evicted. Image-conscious housemates can also stay body beautiful in the exercise room, which has been kitted out with the latest gym equipment. Now, for me, Big Brother was big news originally, but in recent years, when it comes to the regular series, we've had winners such as Thingy and Who's It and whatchamacallit. I mean, just who can remember who was previously won? So I certainly can't. Anyway, that's Big Brother starting again on Thursday at 9 o'clock on Channel 5. And when it comes to some TV news, is Nighty Night making a comeback? Tormenting a disabled neighbour, lusting after said neighbour's husband, and embarking on the odd killing spree, it was all part of Julia Davis's Jill Tyrrell in Nighty Night, and there's plans for it to return after a six-year break. Angus Dayton has said, Julia's got an idea for the third series and is currently in the process of putting it all together. Billed as a West Country version of Fatal Attraction, the comedy aired between 2004 and 2005. Highlights included Jill riding a horse into her husband's funeral, even though he wasn't dead, she just did enjoy the attention, before dancing to All By Myself alongside Ruth Jones, who played her assistant Linda. Series 2 ended with Jill finally landing a man, albeit unconscious, and taking off on a speedboat. The BBC wanted a third series straight after the last one, but Julia was busy on other projects, said Angus. He added, it feels right to revisit it now, though, and I can't wait to see where Julia takes the characters next. Well, I absolutely loved the first series, but the second was severely lacking for me and just seemed to throw away clever comedy in favour of... comedy writing in favour of gross-out behaviour, rather like Little Britain. So forgive me if I don't rush into it with arms wide open. I'll be having a little bit more TV news in a moment, but first a quick bit of music. I have Mike and the Mechanics and Over My Shoulders. 106.6.
106.6.
Now this last section to take us up to the top of the hour, we've got a few more bits of TV news for you. Starting with, there'll be a new series of Little Crackers for Sky One. Now, Little Crackers, the series of short stories written and directed by comedians about their own childhood, will return to Sky One this Christmas, it has been announced. The Strand debuted on the channel in 2010 with 12 individual episodes written by, and often directed by and starring, comedy names such as Victoria Wood, Bill Bailey, Chris O'Dowd, Mira Sayal and Stephen Fry. The 2011 series will present stories on the theme of The First Time I, with John Bishop, Sanjeev Bhaskar and Alan Davis already signed up to tell their stories. Further comedians are expected to be announced in the coming months. Lucy Lumsden, head of comedy at Sky, said, last year, Little Crackers was a fantastic success for Sky One HD, bringing some of the biggest and best names in British comedy to the channel. But there are always more names I wanted to be a part of the show, and I'm delighted to have secured such brilliant comedians for the second series. Some of the news is that Morgana Robinson is to star in the Channel 4 Impressions show. Up-and-coming comic actress Morgana Robinson, who took the lead in the Morgana show, is set to appear in another sketch show for Channel 4. The Sun reported that Robinson and Terry Minot, who also appeared in the show, are to front a new impression show for the channel, provisionally titled VIP. The Morgana show attracted modest ratings when it was broadcast in November and December last year. Scheduled alongside the controversial Frankie Boyle's Terminal Nights, it managed an average of less than 700,000 viewers an episode across a five-part series. However, Robinson was praised by the press for her acting and impressions ability. Not much is yet known about the new series, but The Sun has published a clip from the show in which Robinson and Minot pretended to be Daybreak presenters Christine Bleakley and Adrian Childs, with a duo desperate to find viewers to watch their show. VIP will be made by agent John Knoll and his production company Running Bear Pictures. The Sun notes the sketch seems to be a response to the fact that Bleakley dumped John Knoll as her agent when she moved to Daybreak. The paper quotes a source who reportedly said of the sketch, John's had this idea for a while. He feels really let down by Christine after she dumped him by text and flounced off to ITV. He told her that going to ITV would be a bad idea even, and the ratings for Daybreak have proved he was right. In fairness, he still thinks she's a great presenter, but this is just a bit of fun to remind her she was better off with him. The new sketch show is one of a string of commissions by Channel 4, which has boosted its comedy budget by £5 million in an attempt to find new comedy hits. In the last fortnight, Channel 4 has revealed the lineups for its comedy lab and showcase strands, in which a total of 13 shows will be piloted, all of which I've previously mentioned on this show. And VIP is expected to broadcast on Channel 4 later this year. One last bit of news. Spooks is to finish spying after the following series. As the award-winning spy drama Spooks enters its 10th series, producers Kudos Films and Television have revealed that after a decade on screen, the show will bow out at the end of its next run on BBC One this autumn. Jane Featherstone, chief executive of Kudos Films and TV, and the show's executive producer said, we've always wanted to end Spooks on a high, but never knew that when that time would be. Harry Pearce, played by the wonderful Peter Firth, has always been at the heart of the show, and this series focuses on Harry's past, bringing his tumultuous relationship with Ruth to a head. As we near completion of this year's show, I'm sorry to say, but it feels this series is a fitting end to a much-loved show. It feels that way, anyway. It's very tempting to keep going, but we have had ongoing conversations with our partners at the BBC about it, but the heart of the show has become those two characters, and I feel they own it. We followed the arc of their personal story, and I think that brought us to a natural end, all of which you'll see played out later this year. Okay, so that's all your TV news for this week, and that's everything to do with the DVD Fever Show for this week. So thanks very much to those who listened, and say all the links to any gameplay footage and film trailers, etc., they're on the Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/DVD Fever Show. So in a moment at 2 o'clock, we're coming up with the Aaron Metta Show, but to take us up to the top of the hour, we'll be having Neil Diamond and Love on the Rocks. This is 106.6.
106.6.